Well, thank you, Jeff. Today's talk is not technical, a little bit more technical than yesterday. So I hope you bear with me if you know the subject well. But otherwise, I hope you can understand what I'm talking. So this is the second part of the book related to the second part of the talk related to the book, The Shape of the Inner Space. And at the heart of this is the mathematical conjecture, as I mentioned to you yesterday, the Calabi conjecture, which ties topology to geometry and, in fact, ties differential equations with geometry in a very essential manner. And as I said yesterday, my colleagues and I believe the conjecture was too good to be true. And for many years, I tried very hard to prove that it was wrong. Until I realized, after a big struggle, that my original belief was wrong. In fact, the Calabi conjecture was in fact supposed to be true. So I spent many years trying to build up some models, build up some tools to prove the conjecture. And as I said, I was fortunate to have several young dependent geometers who are also interested in dependent equations. We work together. One important person is my friend S.Y. Chen, and the other one is Rick Shen and Leon Simon. Working with S.Y. Chen, we understand the ideas that come from maximal principle. And the others are coming from integrated by parts. So two different major approach in solving nonlinear differential equations. And both of them were used by people in a different way before us. Somehow I need to use both of them. And this was really a good education coming from my friends coming from different directions. They taught me in Stanford, and we were working together rather seriously. Anyway, my confidence in this problem was getting better and better, and maybe possibly because my girlfriend and I finally got engaged at the time when I visited her in Princeton. That's what I mentioned to you yesterday. And then we drove from Princeton to Los Angeles during 1976 in May. It was a really enjoyable trip. But for me, I actually on the road for 10 days and trying to go out for sightseeing, but I was working hard. Actually thinking about the kind of estimate that I need to do. And this kind of estimate, of course, I'm thinking about it for so hard so I can do the calculation in my brain. But now many people still need to use a pencil to calculate it on paper. But once you think about it so hard, you think really it's not so hard. But anyway, I was rather ambitious as a young man. I was trying to prove the Poincaré conjecture and the Calabi conjecture at the same time. The Poincaré conjecture is always fascinating for every geometer. I was in Stony Brook, and Jim Simons wanted to prove it using the Trent-Simons invariant, but so far has nothing come out using that approach. Many approaches was tried by many people, and I was hoping to use minimal surface to settle the Poincaré conjecture. There was some concrete idea, it's not just talks. And this idea did not quite well up to now, but the potential is still there. And if people are interested in those ideas, I think it's still interesting to try to work it out. So anyway, I did not have many concrete ideas about Poincaré conjecture, but I did have better luck with Calabi conjecture. Because during the driving, I start to think about estimates that I need to solve nonlinear differential equations. So, well, to solve a nonlinear differential equation, you can make many beautiful approaches to it formally, but the heart of matter is to do estimates, to control the terms in the equation. When you differentiate once, you differentiate twice, you want to see the gradient, how they changes. And these are the so-called estimates. Well, I start to learn about what estimate is good for and work hard for you for many days. Well, I'm doing the estimate in my head without telling my fiance at that time, although we are watching and taking pictures along. And it was very nice. So by the time I arrived in Los Angeles, my friends in UCLA were very friendly. We found a temporary apartment, and then we went out to buy the first house with my future wife. At the same time, I was still struggling to try to understand the estimates. By the time when I got married in early September and moved to the house in San Fernando Valley, I was using an office right next to Robert Greene, who invited me to go there for a visit. It was a small office, but I have a lot of interest in conversation with my friends there. And there are many of the interesting ideas we communicate, but the marriage really proved to be enjoyable. So within a couple of weeks, I finally get all the estimates that I need to prove the Calabi conjecture. So I was rather pleased by this, naturally. And in fact, you know, I just got married and proved the Calabi conjecture in a few weeks after a long, long struggle. So I was extremely satisfied to be the first person to under this argument that I had just found. And I was sure that it would eventually be an important idea in physics, although I don't know why, it just smells good. So there's a poem written in Chinese at the beginning, convey some of what I was feeling. So it says, in the spring, the flowers are falling while I was watching alone. The pair of birds were flying together in the light rain. So I felt really nice, and I felt I'm mingling with the nature to understand this question. As I said, the Calabi conjecture was linked to general relativity, and I feel really good about it. But actually, the original proof of the Calabi conjecture and the motivation was based completely on geometric reason. I want to understand curvature, the part of the curvature which is called Ricci curvature, and I want to understand what that means in geometry. And I felt if I do not understand the Calabi conjecture, I would never understand what Ricci curvature means. So it is actually not just a question of conjecture, it is a question of fundamental building block of geometry to understand curvature. So I was very pleased by it. But then, you remember yesterday, I said I made many, many earlier attempts to disprove the Calabi conjecture. So how did it work? You assume the Calabi conjecture is true, and you derive many, many consequences, and you hope those consequences are wrong. That's what it means to give a counterexample. You base on the fact that it's true, and then derive consequences and prove the consequences are wrong. So that was attempt. Now those attempts seem to be waste. But now once you know the conjecture is true, all these counterexamples become statements that are freedoms now. Because you derived them, you were trying to prove they are wrong, and you did not know why it is wrong. Until now, you know it's actually right, because the theorem is proved. So many of these statements turns out to be actually important statements. At the time when I was trying to give counterexample, we don't believe that it's true, but now it becomes important statements. So let me give you one example of how important one of those statements were. So in fact, in September 1976, within a month I got married, Munford gave a seminar talk in UCLA on solitons. He was interested in solitons in those days. He came and gave a secret seminar because he's very famous. He didn't want to have too many people in the seminar. And he told my friend David Giesinger he would give a seminar to only a few people. So I went to his talk. I always considered to be a friend with David, so he let me in to listen to him. And it was nice, but more importantly, David Munford said that he's going to give another talk in UCLA. So UC Irvine is about 2 hours drive, 2.5 hours drive in those days, from San Fernando Valley, from my home to there. So I did go there, and it was very fruitful. He discussed a conjecture relating to the work of a Russian mathematician, Bogomolov, about some inequalities between topological numbers of algebraic surfaces. So given a surface defined by polynomial equations, and it's a four-dimensional manifold, there was some conjecture by actually Van der Ven and later by Bogomolov, some inequality between them. This was rather fascinating, and Manford said that this will be great if one can do something about it. I was listening to it and starting at it, I realized that this inequality that Manford wants to prove was actually exact consequence of the Calabi conjecture, which I tried hard to use to disprove the Calabi conjecture before. So now that is true, so it has to be right. So this inequality was indeed right. So I was very happy to see this inequality familiar to myself. I told Manford about it, and this was good. Manford was pleased by it, and after a week, I wrote down all the details and sent it to Manford. He checked it. He was very pleased about it. So this is what later called the Miyoka-Yau inequality, because after about a year, Miyoka actually come up with a computer algebraic proof without using the method I use. But importantly, that this inequality not only is true, but I was able to use that to prove a further result that led to a solution of a famous question given by an Italian geometer, algebraic geometer, Severi. It is concerning about the rigidity of some kind of structure on the projective space. So projective space is a space that algebraic geometers and old geometers has been very used to studying how lines, how planes intersect and all that. And there was an important question where Severi tried to prove and did not prove. And many people want to prove it. And it turns out the Calabi conjecture through this inequality was able to settle this problem. It can be viewed as a Poincaré conjecture in an algebraic setting. And that was actually what Manford said. This is, should be looked at as a Calabi, as a Poincaré conjecture in an algebraic setting. So this is one of the important consequences of the Calabi conjecture, to have some idea on topology of algebraic surface and also on the rigidity of it. So I actually become very famous instantly because of this solution of the conjecture. And well, within a short time, a lot of works, further works were developed by this line of thinking, not only in terms of inequality, but many important results based on the Calabi conjecture was developed at that time. I was pretty happy with the setting in UCLA, and because I met Bill Mix, who was a hippie actually at that time. And Mix and I also had a common interest, because while I was in Berkeley as a graduate student, and Mix was an undergraduate. So we went together, we used minimal surface again to solve some important question, linking geometry with topology, again. So it's always an important thing behind me to try to link geometry with topology. And this was used to solve an important question along with the important theorem of Bill Thurston. It was used to solve the Smith conjecture, which I did not want to go into detail. But anyway, in a period of a short time, all this come together, and within a year, which is rather gratifying for me that I was able to Have a very nice year, both personally and professionally. I got married and I solved several important problems at the same time. Anyway, upon solving the Calliope conjecture, I had a strong sense that I had hit upon a beautiful piece of mathematics, which can be seen by proving many important consequences of it in algebraic geometry and differential geometry. However, I feel it must be relevant to physics, to our deepest understanding of nature also. The reason is that the conjecture can be rephrased in terms Einstein, in terms of Einstein's equation, and I feel something must be important for physics, but I did not know what, because the metric we use is Riemannian metric, not quite the Lorentzian metric that Einstein's equation called for. So I asked many of my friends in physics, and they did not know much about it either, and I did not know enough physics at the time to think about how to apply it. So it was just stored there. On the other hand, I did have a lot of interaction with physicists by this time, because I have been interested in general relativity for quite a while. In 1973, I was exposed to a problem in general relativity called the positive mass conjecture. This was in the Stanford conference I mentioned yesterday. The physicist Robert Geros discussed this important question in general relativity. So the question is an important one because it really means general relativity, as was conceived by Einstein, is stable, in the sense that based on the equation, the whole universe could not collapse, would not collapse. So this is very important. And this was mentioned in the same conference where I tried to disprove the Calliope conjecture, which I mentioned yesterday. This was very exciting days because many geometers talk about this problem and try to solve it. And I worked on this problem with my friend, Rick Shen. And basically, as I said, in simple terms, the conjecture says that the mass of the universe has to be positive. If the mass turns out to be negative, the whole universe would collapse. Configuration of a galaxy and all that would run away and collapse. Now, this is rather important, therefore, and we try and try very hard. Finally, in 1978, we settled this problem with a lot of work also. And this make use of the plateau problem that I mentioned in the first part of my talk. So we need the solving the minimal surface in order to apply to prove the energy is positive. Because the energy negative would cause some different geometry, and that and allow us to prove the plateau problem has some peculiar property, which we managed to prove it cannot be true. So anyway, the proof of the positive mass conjecture brought me closer to my friends in physics. So this is a fundamental question which is finally solved. In fact, before we solve it, the relativists has a meeting each year to discuss about this problem. So when we solve it, they don't quite believe it at the beginning. Now, so I run a special year of geometric seminars at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton in 1979. And there are quite a few physicists participate because our solution of the positive mass conjecture. And I moved to the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton as a faculty member after that. And there were many young postdoc fellows in the Institute. In 1981, I offered Gary Horowitz to be my postdoc fellowship, to be my postdoc fellow in, with the intention to work on classical relativity that year, 1981. And at that time, Andy Strominger was also a postdoc in the Institute. Now, then At that time, I told them about the solution of Calabi conjecture, that I can construct a vacuum space and with non-trivial gravity. They kind of say that, well, that sounds interesting, but we don't know what is the use of those things. Until in 1984, when I visited San Diego, my wife was in San Diego, and I visited her, and in her office, I was watching the beautiful ocean of San Diego. I got several phone calls during that time in my wife's office. Both Horowitz and Andy Strominger said that they were very excited about a model for describing the vacuum state of the universe based on a new theory called string theory. So I did not know much about string theory whatsoever, and I have no idea what they were talking, but they start to describe to me what that means. So they said that there's a subject called string theory, and it's built on the assumption that particles, instead of being a pawn, at the very basic level, are made of vibrating bits of tiny strings, vibrating in space-time. So now the question is, you need to quantize this whole theory. So mapping of the tiny strings in space-time. You want to do a quantization procedure. So this is called sigma model in physics. And they do the quantization. In general, it will be inconsistent by doing it. Then they make assumption that the space-time has a certain symmetry, which nowadays is called supersymmetry. And if you make that assumption, the quantization procedure becomes much better, much more consistent. As we know, there are many infinities occur when we do quantum gravity using different approach. And turns out, at least in the first term, it was finite. It was rather gratifying for the physicists. And they also found out, in order for all this to be true, the space-time has to be 10 dimensional. Otherwise, it's inconsistent. There is something called conformal anomaly will occur. So therefore, they have no choice to assume space-time has to be 10 dimensional. And they prefer the space-time should have a symmetry, which is called supersymmetry. So this is forced to them by quantum physics, quantization of the strings vibrating in space-time. So making the assumption that space-time has supersymmetry and 10 dimensions, they see things go well. So now, this is a general theory with no construction of what the space-time is supposed to be. So Horowitz and Strominger is then interested to build a model to see how string theory can be realized, that you can use it to describe the real world, to describe the world as you see it. So what do you want to do? There was based on some old theory in general relativity, you propose that the space-time being 10 dimensions is actually 4 dimensions with the 6th dimension, extra 6th dimensional space, being compact and very, very tiny. It curl up. So what does that mean? That means the space-time as we see it is 4 dimensions, so you see x, y, and z coordinate, and plus time, so it's 4 dimensions. And what happens is that at each point in 4 dimensions, you see there's a very small, tiny, six-dimensional object, which is called Calabi-Yau space now. And everywhere there's such a six-dimensional space, curl up. And it's so small, so you don't see it. And based on that, you want to say this six-dimensional space should be consistent with string theory. What string theory require? In other words, you should have some kind of supersymmetry. So remember, I said at the beginning, to build a model of string theory, we need the concept of supersymmetry. And they want 10 dimensions space time is automatic because now it's 4 dimensions plus 6 dimensions. So now we require the 6 dimensional space to acquire supersymmetry. Now, in order to build the vacuum state of the whole theory, which is important, is they want this 6 dimensional space to be vacuum, has no matter. So this would be the vacuum state of string theory, which will initiate the vibrating for mass and everything. Anyway, in order to build such a model, they want a supersymmetry and vacuum, no matter. And yet they don't want it to be trivial, so the curvature should be non-trivial. So they want a 6-dimensional space which admits supersymmetry and admit the fact that the Ricci curvature is identical zero. So they didn't know how to produce such a space. My friends, Horowitz and Schrödinger, they were very anxious to have such a thing because they want to say that string theory can be realized as a model that can be used to test out on the phenomenological questions. So to their delight, I told them this exactly what I told them 8 years ago. And in that time, to them, it's about 3 years ago. Anyway, this was the one that I constructed in the Calabi conjecture 8 years ago. So they were very happy with that. And then I got another phone call around the same time, just a couple of days later, by Ed Witten, who, of course, we know is really a great physicist. And I met him in Princeton. He was still young, and so am I at that time. And I met him a year before that, in connection with the proof of the positive mass conjecture. As I mentioned to you, Rick Shen and I proved the positive mass conjecture, proving that general relativity is stable under gravity. And we can give another proof, more conceptual in terms of physics. So he's tried me as a genius in many ways. But he gave me a call. He was in Princeton at the time. He told me that string theory would be one of the most exciting, is one of the most important theory, and is creating one of the most exciting eras in the theoretical physics. He told me it's just like the time when quantum mechanics was being developed. And this is very exciting, sounds very good. He told me, everyone who make a contribution to quantum mechanics in the early days, like, of course, Heisenberg, Dirac, Schrödinger, all these left their names in the history of physics. And he said, the important discovery of string theories, such as Michael Green or John Swartz, could lead to the grand unification of all forces. And it would be the same as those early discoveries of quantum mechanics. The name will be left in the history of physics. The goal is to finish what Einstein dreamed about, namely to prove that there's a unification between all forces in nature. So that's what Witten told me. He basically tried to encourage me to look into string theory much more. So then I found out he was collaborating with both Philip Candelas and with Gary Horowitz and Schrödinger. And they wrote the first paper on how to use Calabi-Yau space to predict the nature. So what's going on? They want to figure out the geometry, the shape of the six-dimensional space of string theory. That's the title of the book, The Shape of the Inner Space. And this inner space is everywhere. It's very tiny. If we do quantum physics on the 10-dimensional space-time, the particle you see can be reflected by understanding this geometry. The reason is, if you take the geometry of this 6-dimensional space to be very, very tiny, very, very tiny, the spectrum of the Dirac operator will be divided into several parts. those with no mass and those with mass, then those with mass would be really, really heavy because the diameter of this geometry is very tiny. The eigenvalue of an operator is inverse proportional to r squared of the geometry. So if the radius of this geometry is really, really, really tiny, the particle that you will see will be too heavy to be seen. So therefore, the spectrum is divided into two parts. One has no eigenvalue, spectrum equals zero, and the other one will have a spectrum, which you will not see. Those with trivial spectrum is exactly related to the geometry through harmonic feeding. And this was marvelous, because then now we can use topology of the six-dimensional space to calculate the particle that occurs in the universe. And everything is curved into this tiny space, and yet this tiny space could contribute to the number of particles that we see in nature, and we can potentially do many things about it. Namely, we can see how they interact together, we can potentially even calculate the basic constant of nature. So, although we cannot see it, it's very tiny, but the quantum mechanical calculation shows that you can still have influence from this six-dimensional space-time, this six additional dimensions hidden away, in understanding the physics of the four-dimensional space-time through the geometry of these extra dimensions. So this is really fascinating. And this is fantastic because the exact geometry of this space dictates the properties of our universe and the kind of physics we see. And it determines the kind of particles that exist, their masses, the way in which they interact, and maybe even the constant of nature. So that was the basic hope at that time. The hope may be too much, but so far it's still there, that we would be able to use the geometry of the space to determine the basic particles that we see. So potentially, we should be able to calculate the mass of the electron, the proton, and all that, out of all this geometry, out of this shape of inner space. So now you recall, and I said yesterday, when Einstein said the phenomena of gravity is really a manifestation of geometry. So he said, you know, Newtonian gravity is not just action of heavy bodies, but actually it's all come from geometry. The geometry or the curvature of space-time tell you the gravity. Now the string theorists proposed, boldly proclaimed that the physics of our universe is a consequence of the geometry of Calabi-Yau space. So the basic particles will, the strong interaction, weak interaction, all those important questions about particles should come out from the geometry. And based on some gauge theory over the Calabi-Yau space, we should be able to predict everything. So therefore, the string theory is really anxious to figure out the precise geometry of this six-dimensional space. A problem we are still working on, unfortunately, because the problem is far more complicated than what we know before. Now, this does not mean that there's any contradiction here. There's no contradiction. It's just that we need to understand much more about this space. So that's why Witten was eager to learn more about this space. In fact, so eager, he flew from Princeton to San Diego just to talk with me about the construction of this tiny space, this Calabi-Yau space. And we spent a full day to work on it. I knew quite a bit more than him at that time. After a month, he knew far more than me. So he really fast. He wanted to learn how many Calabi-Yau space that we can choose among. Initially, they were so excited because they thought there are only two. There are only two examples. And if there are two examples, of course, we just fool around and calculate everything about them, then we would be able to test out whether the fundamental physics is consistent with string theory and all that. And then at that point, they were too arrogant. They call it theory of everything. They hope everything can be calculated. But it's not quite true, unfortunately. There are many more. And in fact, they were somewhat disappointed when I told them there are about 10,000 at least of this Clavio space. Well, this does not mean there's any inconsistent. It just means that there are many more we need to choose from. The question is how to choose them. It's not, 10,000 examples is not so bad. I mean, we have powerful computers. We have many ingenious mathematicians who can try to figure out what we need if we know the criteria to choose them. Unfortunately, the criteria to choose this has not been able to figure out in a fundamental way. There's, for example, there's some way to pick out some. Namely, we know as by Heidegger physics experiment that the number of family of fermions in nature is supposed to be free. And that translates to the following statement that the Euler number of the Clavio space has to be equal to plus or minus 6. So you can see from here the very close link between particle content and the geometry of Clavio space. So let me repeat again. We know the number of fermions as a family, there are only 3 families. But here, it turns out we can say that equivalently, the Euler number, which is a topological content of the Clavio space, is equal to 6 or minus 6. So that was a very strong constraint of what kind of Clavio space you could have. So we know that. But we do not quite happy with such a statement because the fact that the number of fermions is equal to 6, is equal to 3, is a statement that we learn from experiment. We still would like to derive everything from basic principle. And this basic principle is still not completely understood. There's nothing inconsistent about them, it's just that we are still not able to find this basic principle yet, either by physics or by mathematics. So the task of figuring out the shape of this inner space seems to be more daunting and interesting on the other hand. And to some people, they are even considered hopeless. I consider this is challenging and interesting, and this probably takes a few more years ago, maybe 10 more years ago. We have to understand the topology and the classification of such space. And we hope, I personally believe that, the number of topology that can support Clavio space is finite. And it could be big, but on the other hand, as long as it's finite and we know what they are, we should have means to calculate them and make serious contribution. But so far, this is still a very interesting and important question in algebraic geometry and differential geometry. How to figure out and classify the number of such topology. And so far, we know about 10,000 or a little bit more, but not much more, but you can build physics out of it. When you build physics out of it, you put in gauge theory, you put in many things. Then at the end, you can build to a big number, 10 to the power 500 possibilities. But this all because we do not know a fundamental principle to pick out the right one. Well, the great excitement over Clavio space started in 1984. So that was a time when I mentioned to you, Ed Witten and all wanted to talk with me about it. And, just like in any theory in physics, they die down somehow. The enthusiasm kept on only for a few years, they died down. They were looking for other things to substitute the Clavio space. But then the excitement picked up in 1988. Brian Greene, was my postdoc at the time, 1988. He worked as my postdoc and with a graduate student in Harvard, Ronald Presser. They worked together. At the same time, Felix Candelas and his group also pick up an important direction. It's called mirror symmetry. So this is come out of blue. Mathematicians look at Calabi's face. Some of the examples has been studied for many, many years, in fact. And we work and we look at each individual space and happily discuss about their geometry and talk about their behavior. But we never thought about among different Calabi's space, they could be linked in some special way. And this is very interesting. And in fact, when Brian Green come to my office, tell me that, you know, there are two Calabi's space and they have different topology, and yet they have doesn't seem to have anything in common, and yet they give rise to the same physics. So I said, well, what do you mean? I mean, they give rise to the same physics? Well, you can derive from the meaning of this statement many interesting geometric properties of the space. And when he told me, I start to be astonished by the possibility. First of all, I say that how can that happen? At that time in 1988, we started to construct a large family of such space. Most of them has negative order number. And the partner, or the different topology, although they are quite different, the other partner has to have opposite order number. So namely, at those cases, we found many, many examples with negative order number, and yet they call for positive order number appear in the same pair. And I thought that's not possible. From our experience in mathematics, but the reason is only because we are somewhat more lazy. We saw a few hundred and we thought that's enough examples. Then Candelas actually run a computer program to use some of the simple idea that I make. It turns out he calculated many more. And then you see that indeed there's some symmetry. Those with negative order number has a partner with positive order number. And now, in the first approximation, we see there's some possibility, namely a pair of different Calabi's with different topology may give rise to something interesting. But this is very superficial still. You just know the order number looks good. But then they start to discover something far more powerful and interesting. And they propose something from mirror symmetry. They said, for one Calabi's space, you produce a quantum field theory, which is difficult to compute, the quantum field theory. They have a strong coupling, what they call, difficult to calculate. Their other partner turns out to give different, they give the same quantum physics, but with weak coupling, which means that perturbation theory is possible in the other space. So given two different Calabi's space, the physics, although they are the same, one is much easier to handle than the other one. For one of them, you can use perturbation theory, the other one is too hard to calculate. Because they are the same, so therefore you transform a difficult problem of one Calabi's space to another one, which is much easier and can be calculated. So this was a instant success in quantum theory, because now you can calculate something which is impossible to calculate by something which is manageable. And this becomes a fascinating fact for mathematics, because some of the old problem in mathematics was very difficult to calculate, and based on mirror symmetry, we found a formula. And this formula was inspired by string theory, by the mirror symmetry calculation. And this physical intuition is good because finally we proved those formulas to be accurate by completely different means. By rigorous mathematics, we prove those physical intuitions are good and can be verified. And this solves some old outstanding questions, sometimes some of them is even a century old. So what is a century old problem? It is sometimes called enumerative geometry. So basically, you want to look at some algebraic manifold or some manifold defined by polynomials, and you want to count the number of solutions in terms of curves sitting inside there. So you can solve, you can watch how many simple lines sitting in the complicated geometry. And this was asked by algebraic geometer more than 100 years ago. And we did not know how to count them. Algebraic geometer started counting it one by one, degree equal to 1, degree equal to 2, degree equal to 3. And by the time when you watch, when they come to degree equal to 4, they become very difficult. They don't know how to move after that. But then the physicists come up with a formula. The formula works for arbitrary degree. It's all based on physical intuition. So now, fortunately, after a few years, after about 6 years, a group of mathematicians, including Givantao, including myself, Catherine Liu, and Bong Liang, we proved that to be true. So what does that mean? That means the physical intuition construct by physicists can be proved to be right. It's actually carried out in a rigorous manner. Transition from physical intuition to the formula is extremely complicated procedure. And this is rather interesting because mathematicians could not come up with that formula, even up to now. Although we now know how to prove those difficult formula, important formula, we still could not come up with an idea how this formula was constructed, except we went through the physics intuition. And yet we proved it by a completely formal manner and a rigorous manner. So it's a really true cooperation between physicists and mathematicians. They provide an intuition to give rise to those beautiful formula, and we prove that. So, in a way, we justify their physical intuition, and vice versa, we use their physical intuition to give us a way, leading a dilation to prove important formula. Now, this is therefore an extremely important progress made in the last 30 years, and in fact, there are many more development going in that direction. There are many subjects in mathematics which seems to be unrelated at the beginning. Now it was justified and linked together by string theory ideas. Although string theory never provide a way to prove anything in mathematics, but they provide a dilation. The dilation often can be justified by rigorous mathematics. So it was very pleasant cooperation between physicists and mathematicians. But on the other hand, in conclusion, we cannot get too carried away, because after all, the subject we call string theory is still, after all, a theory. In terms of experiment, because a physical theory needs to be judged by physical experiments in order to describe nature. This really, some of them is not really the fault of the theory, because the space is so tiny and it cannot be seen by experiment. And of course, there are some proposals by physicists. One of them is to look at a string in the early universe. When the Big Bang occurs, the string is really very tiny. And then after the inflation and all that, it becomes a cosmic string. And one was hoping to see the cosmic string in the sky. In fact, about 5 or 6 years ago, there was a candidate proposed in the sky that people thought that it was a fundamental string. And this was proposed in Russian at the beginning. And finally, the observation was better and better, and they decided it's not the same. So they excluded it. But in any case, there was a proposal to use cosmology to determine whether a fundamental strain could be there or not. But of course, in CERN, in LHC, people is trying to test whether you can find the supersymmetric particle or not. Whether the supersymmetric particle is possible to be detected, and one hopes that it can be detected. In that case, people would believe string theory could actually describe nature. So this would be very fascinating and interesting if that is the case. But on the positive side of the whole thing, I consider it to be a powerful and intricate way that mathematics has been inspired by string theory. Many of these, as I said, would not have been thought about if string theories were not around, helping us to see the right formula, the right direction. And of course, we are pleased that we can prove the physical intuition given by string theory has been valid. And this kind of test has been going on for many, many times. Each time is amazing that turns out to be right. So it may be something to it, or maybe that's not. But the whole theory has been beautiful, that's for sure. Mathematics that come out of it has been beautiful. They are trying to unify different forks of nature, but instead they have unified many different areas of mathematics, which is rather rewarding to be able to see quite different mathematics under different umbrella was able to contact each other through the influence of string theory. And I have been going to the seminar quite often in physics department, and I always feel very excited to see some new connection was proposed by them. And usually they are very difficult to be justified, but so far we have not found a single example that it cannot be justified. Everything that comes out seems to have been true. Well, of course, I'm talking about a good physicist. There are many poor physicists propose something which is wrong. But most of my friends in Harvard did propose something which works out to be nicer. Well, we do not know what the final work would be, but we can say that, combining with my talk yesterday, we know that over 2,000 years, the concept of geometry has evolved in many important states to the current state of modern geometry. And each time when geometry moves, transformed in a major way, we see a new version was incorporated in our improved understanding of nature. So when Euclidean geometry was conceived, we see some interesting ideas, and Archimedes and many people has making breakthroughs in physics. And then there's analytic geometry, there's Newtonian way of looking at gravity based on the newly discovery of calculus. And then, as I said, in 19th century, when Gauss and Riemann developed the abstract space-time, it was used by Einstein to formulate the gravity, theory of gravity, which gave rise to general relativity. That was a really major breakthrough in science. And so each time when we have a major understanding of modern geometry, we see a major way to understand physics or nature. And vice versa, we see that each advances in theoretical physics give rise to an important understanding of mathematics or geometry. In fact, the major development of quantum mechanics has been a very major development for geometers. And many of them are very mysterious to us still, because quantum mechanics is not so easy to understand. And the geometry that come up from it has been fascinating and mysterious to us. But it seems likely that we shall witness another major development in the 21st century, the concept of quantum geometry. And many people talk about this concept, but we don't know what they are. Namely, we really want a geometry that can incorporate quantum physics in the small and general relativity in the large. That's something we call for as a unified theory between all forces, because in a small quantum realm is described more discretely, and in a large, the continuous realm given by general relativity dominating. So how do we formulate a geometry that can put both them together? And that's a very important question, and certainly it's a major thing that string theorists want to solve, and in fact all the physicists, theoretical physicists, like to know. And of course it's the same question that big curiosity for geometers, why such a geometry could be there, and how are we going to build about it? This probably will take the whole 21st century to understand, but we can see that certainly people in physics, in mathematics, and especially differential geometers, would have to put a lot of work into it, maybe a number of physics too. Anyway, this is a fascinating future that we are looking forward. Anyway, I wrote this book is because I feel that abstract mathematics can reveal so much about nature. It's something I find both mysterious and fascinating. And we try to get across this view in this book, The Shape of Inner Space. We also hope that the book gives general people a description of how mathematics works. They are not necessarily the real people, such as a janitor who solves century-old math problems on the sidewalk while mopping and dusting floor, as described in the movie Good Will Hunting, which I was approached by many friends about the Good Will Hunting, asking whether that's possible. And, well, I don't think it's possible, but anyway. And also, it has been, in the last 10 years, many news media try to describe that a billion mathematician has to be either mentally ill or lock himself up away from people for a long time and has some bizarre phenomena, behavior, in order to be good. Well, I don't believe that is the case. And so I really would like to say that we are just ordinary people, but we try to understand nature from a different, more abstract point of view. And this is good because it provides a global and better understanding sometimes than physicists. And we are based on the truth and beauty of nature also, except we look at it in more abstract point of view. And also, the book tries to convey the thrill of working at an interface between mathematics and physics, showing how important ideas flow from different disciplines, with the result being the birth of new and important subjects, especially mathematics. But even in physics, for example, string theory gave rise to an important point of view on duality and introduced the so-called ADS-CFT duality. And that duality has been extremely important, even in condensed matter, independent of string theory. So this interface between mathematics and physics create new subjects in both geometry and in physics. And they are very fruitful. They are not raised. Even if cannot be found in LHC, I think the consequence has been fruitful. And, well, I think geometry and physics has created, as I said, beautiful mathematics. And the mathematics is so beautiful, it has branched out into so many different areas, which makes you wonder whether the physicists may be true, may be onto something which is real after all. The whole story is still unfolding, and I consider myself to be lucky to be part of it. So I hope many of my younger friends would feel the same thing. That's one of the reasons I write this book. Thank you.
Yourself as a pure mathematician. Your girlfriend saw a physics of no knowledge to you at the beginning. Especially you knew more about your girlfriend, you like her, you love her, and marry her to produce two sons of my future. That means a perfect marriage of mathematics and physics, you definitely produce.
Well, first of all, my wife and I never talk about physics. We try to collaborate at one point, never succeed because we have paid more attention to children. And as far as seeing my first girlfriend, my girlfriend, we fell in love at the first sight, so it has never changed. It doesn't really change my view about physics. But on the other hand, it was very pleasant to have a wife who knows physics and inspiring, after all.
If you did understand which was the correct Kalabi Yao,
yes.
What would that tell you about the 10-dimensional space?
The 10-dimensional space would just mean Minkowski space time times the Kalabi Yao. It's a product. Yeah. Now, I should say this is for fundamental physics. Just like we are interested in the particle physics, just look at something that's small. There are also string cosmology, which is different from this model.
And how do you know
that it's tiny? Well, as I just mentioned, actually, if the Kalabi-Yau space is big, the first thing will occur is that there are many particles which is not supposed to be there, could be seen in our day-to-day life. And we don't see them, so they cannot be big. Cannot be big, so it has to be small. When it's small, the particle mass would be so big that you don't see them. So all the particle that is so huge, so heavy, would not be seen, and it would be consistent with our observation. So the fact is small is more or less linked with phenomenological ideas that we don't see those particles. So they better be small. Okay. The mass of the particle is linked to the 1/diameter² of the space. Well, first of all, I'm doing classical physics, semi-classical approximated quantum physics. So matter is described only by partial curvature, not the full curvature. So, and Kalabi conjecture proposed a way to write down the equation in a much simpler form under the jargon of Kähler geometry. So if you have supersymmetry, there's a much better way to write down the equation for Einstein's equation. And based on that equation, which we can solve, you can construct many of those space. It reduces the problem to some questions in algebraic geometry. So in algebraic geometry, they are powerful enough to construct many interesting examples which fit the hypothesis of the Kalabi conjecture. So therefore, we can construct many of these spaces based on algebraic geometry. So the classification of Kalabi-Yau space largely becomes a question in algebraic geometry. But our algebraic geometry friends are not powerful enough to solve this problem yet.
Thank you.